Welcome to Chapter 17. Yeah, what they did in the third, between the third and the fourth edition, is they moved this Chapter 7 of the third and previous editions back towards the end of the book and made it one of the optional chapters, basically. And then in the new Chapter 7, they included this behavioral finance and other topics that were very in the news at the time of the fourth edition. But ratio analysis is very important. We've already done a little bit. We'll do quite a bit more in this chapter. So let's read together. Chapter 14 of 17 of the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions, and Chapter 7 of the 3rd edition deal mainly with financial statements and ratio analysis. It is important enough to warrant our attention. And we will look at all the ratios in the chapter, but we'll just compute a few as we go by. Let's skip the forecasting because we've already done quite a bit of forecasting in Chapter 6. And by the way, Mr. Benjamin Graham in the Intelligent Investor relies quite heavily on ratio analysis. So that's enough to warrant our attention, isn't it? It's enough to give us pause and think we better understand this stuff. Slide number 2, financial statements. There are three financial statements that are, by law, required to be filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission every 3 months by publicly traded corporations. The balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement, sometimes called the statement of cash flows. It is very different than the cash flow statement that we use in the financial planning class, folks. Don't get confused. The accountants cringe when we call our cash flow statement in financial planning and money management a cash flow statement. That to them, that's an income statement. But hey, we're not going to split hairs. You folks who are taking accounting, you know how to create these financial statements. Relax. Don't go screaming into the night. We're not going to do that. We're going to learn how to analyze them. We rely on the accountants to to do the work for us. The balance sheet is the snapshot. It shows us the firm's assets and then the firm's liabilities, and whatever is left over is called equity, shareholders' equity. We call it net worth in the financial planning class. And then the income statement is more the movie, the financial summary of the operating results of a firm covering a specified period of time, either 3 months or an entire year. Now, what's the cash flow statement? Some of you might say, well, what's the difference? Well, this is where accounting makes life tricky for us, because the statement of cash flows really shows us what's going on behind the scenes with regards to our checkbook. See, our income statement, our earnings statement, tells the IRS how much money we've made so we can pay taxes on that. Whereas the cash flow statement really tells us how much cash is coming in and going out of the company's checkbook. And we've already discussed that at some length, the difference between earnings and cash flow. So we'll continue doing that. So let's take a more detailed look at the balance sheet. This is where in the face-to-face class we would pass out the balance sheet and the cash flow statement, statement of cash flows, and the income statement for Walgreens. And those are on the website. They're public information. Any Yahoo, Bloomberg's, any of the finance websites, you can get them off of. And what are we doing with the balance sheet? Well, we're taking a look at the firm's assets. Anything that the company owns that has value. We're then looking at what obligations, what liabilities the company has, and then we compute the equity, the shareholders' equity. And the formula is assets equals liability plus equity, but we don't normally we don't look at it that way. We normally say take your assets, subtract your liabilities, and what's left over is equity. Now, the accountants make a very strong distinction between current assets and long-term assets. And for them, current means up to a year. So long-term is anything greater than a year. Now, we investors say, no. Long-term is 5, 7, 10 years. Intermediate, they don't have intermediate. So you might want to print out or make sure it's available on your screen the Walgreens balance sheet and take a good look at it now or a little bit later. The next slide discusses the income statement. This one is important. Why? Because it shows you the difference between the company's revenues and their expenses and what money is left over to pay dividends to shareholders. Or you accountants know that if you don't pay out that money that is earned in dividends, it becomes what is called retained earnings. And many companies, when they're growing, they can't pay dividends. They need that cash to pour back into the system. And whatever's left over after the expenses have been paid is called net income. But as we've, and then we'll take a look at the income statement now in the face-to-face class. You want to take a look at it. But as we've said in the past, sometimes income and expenses are not always received or paid in cash, and that's why there is the cash flow statement, slide number 5. The cash flow statement, or as some of the accountants call it, the statement of cash flows, shows us what's going on with the checkbook. And as we said in the past, depreciation is one of the big expenses on our income statement, which really isn't an expense. It's an expense for accounting, and it allows us to reduce our income so we don't pay as much taxes to the tax man. But we didn't pay any money in depreciation. We didn't write out a check to depreciation. So what you'll see when you take a look at the cash flow statement is that it essentially starts where the income statement ends. And you'll see it, they will add back in the depreciation. Why? Because, you know, that's money that's still in the coffers, still in the checkbook of the corporation. And then they'll pull out some things and put in some other things regarding with investment cash flow and financing cash flow, which are entries that don't belong on an income statement. The cash flow statement can be very important because, as we saw, some companies could be reporting record earnings and their checkbook is going down, their checkbook balance, their cash is going down. So stop or later on take a look at Walgreens cash flow statement. Piece of cake? Okay. Where does this information come from? Well, as we said, if a company is publicly traded, they must, part of their obligation is file these financial statements either annually, 10-Ks. I don't know where the K comes from. K. Why do people use K? It stands for strikeout in baseball. And then at the quarterly report, 10-Qs. Well, that makes sense, right? Quarterly, 10-Q. And then the face-to-face, I just say, what was that? What's this one called? And the students go, 10-Q. And I say, you're welcome. Okay, Regulation FD. Well, technology has made it easier for companies to produce this information and distribute it all at the same, at the same time, so that everybody has fair disclosure, and that's called Regulation FD. It requires companies to make public disclosures of material information fairly, so that insider analysts on Wall Street and the like cannot learn about a company's earnings or lack thereof before the general population does. And so what companies do now is they schedule what are called earnings calls. And that was part of your assignment in Chapter 5, is to listen or read one of these earnings calls. And you'll see that it's a bit of a They call it the Dog and Pony Show. It's a bit of a media event sometimes, and the CEO gets up and talks about the company, and then the CFO, the chief financial officer, talks about their finances, and sometimes finances, and then sometimes a marketing director or somebody else will discuss. And obviously, the companies are trying to put their best foot forward, so to speak. They're trying to make everything look as good as possible. And so even though things might not be good, you're going to hear them talk about how great they're going to be, and you have to be able to read between the lines. And then, as we said, at the end of the earnings call, there's often these questions that are, some of them are good questions, and some of them are just really stupid from analysts. And so now, the information must all come out at the same time. There are countless other sources, and for a while there, the trick was to come up with what was called the whisper number. You know, this is the number that's really going to be, hey, listen to me, I'll tell you what they're going to earn. They're not going to earn 55 cents like everybody else believes. I think they're going to earn 58 cents. Short-term traders may want to be able to act on that information, but we long-term prudent investors, long-term oriented, we don't care about one quarterly earnings, do we? I hope not. Anyway, I have heard many investors opine that nowadays there is simply too much information. There's too much going on. In fact, there's a great writer by the name of Nick Murray who writes mostly for people in the industry, but he has this great saying called wisdom sold separately. Exactly. All this information is just too much, and it's not worth anything unless you can apply some kind of wisdom to it. Very, very good. Now, these numbers, are they correct? Well, if you trust the company and trust that they're doing the best job they can to report the correct numbers, yes. But there is one number, and only one number, that you as an investor know is correct. And what is that? How many dividends they paid out. Why? Because they wrote you a check. If they said they pay 50 cents for every shareholder in the form of dividends, you saw that show up in your account. And so that's the one number you can believe. All the other numbers, you know, most companies do the best they can. Some companies are so huge, it's very difficult to gather all the information together. But other times in the past, and sometime in the future, there will be some companies that play fast and loose with the rules. It's fading off into the distance, but there was a company called Enron. It's most spectacular, exactly, spectacular bankruptcy until WorldCom, which was another company, and there were lots of these companies, and there was what was the other one? Adelphia and Global Cross. Still, it's a minority. Yes, it is. Slide number 7. Financial ratios. The relation between two financial quantities expressed as the quotient of one divided by the other. That's what we're going to compute. And ratio analysis is the study of the relationships between the financial statement accounts. Now, as we said before, recall, there is no one ratio that accurately can sum up the overall general state of a company. You can't just look at one of these things and say, ooh, that's the reason I'm going to buy it, or ooh, that's the reason I'm going to sell it. Doesn't work that way. Each ratio must be considered in the context of all the information gathered. And then you must consider these ratios in the context of the industry that the company exists within. And certainly, you want to take a look at their competitors. Right, so we're going to see an example of this soon. Slide number 8. So here are the financial ratios. And some of this is review. We've already discussed price-to-earnings ratio, dividends per share, dividend yield, dividend payout ratio, book value per share, price to book, price to cash flow, price to sales. So this is some review that we're going to go through. Slide number 9, to review, price to earnings ratio. And we can't really discuss PE more than enough. You really can't, you can't discuss it too much. It's the most popular stock market statistic. It doesn't mean it should be the only statistic you look at, but it's certainly the most popular. It's a very simple calculation. You take the market price of the stock and divide it by the earnings per share. Historically, P/E ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 for growing companies, and greater than 20 was unusual, but today it's commonplace. The P/E ratio also tells you how long it will take back in years, assuming no changes in earnings, and they're changing all the time, for the company to earn back its price. A P/E of 3 takes 3 years. A P/E of 20 takes 20 years. Not that that's that important, but it gives you an idea of how long a time horizon investors are thinking. You know, they're thinking, you know, I want to look at this company for the long term. So I'm not worried about what's happening right now. I'm thinking, you know, down the ways they're going to grow their earnings, so I don't mind buying a big company with a huge P.E. Or, you know what, this company better start producing some serious dividends now because it ain't growing that big in the future. Whatever. Slide number 10. Here are six different companies. I think you've heard them all, right? ConocoPhillips, that's 76, the oil company. Google, yeah, right. Amgen is a biotech company. J.P. Morgan Chase, Kellogg's, cornflakes. And Merck is a drug company. And you look at these PEs and you say, wow, you got ConocoPhillips at 9? That's not very good. Google at almost 32? Wow, that's a lot. Amgen, excuse me, 18.5, a little bit, not too high, but a little bit more than the market average. J.P. Morgan, a little bit less. Kellogg's, that's not very exciting at all. And Merck, 30, what's going on here? Well, you really can't just look at individual companies. You have to look at the companies and their competitors. And sure enough, when we add their competitors, we often will see patterns. So let's take a look at the energy companies. You know, as much attention as we pay to oil prices and the like, investors, are they really that excited about the prospects for Conoco and Chevron and Exxon and BP? Not really. I mean, look at BP. Poor BP. Well, they still have that black eye from what they did in the Gulf of Mexico a few years back. But ExxonMobil, with the highest PD, is only close to 13. So as much attention as we pay the price of gas and the like, investors are not that excited about the prospects for the energy companies. I don't know about you, but are people going to be using oil 50 years from now? Yes. Now, hopefully we will have we're not going to get rid of oil. It's too cool a material to forget. But we need to use less of it. We really globally need to use less of it. And, you know, without any help from the government and the politicians, we're doing the best we can. But when we look at Google and its competitors, we see a very different a pattern. Google and Yahoo are pretty close to one another. Baidu, which is like is a Google in China, a little bit higher. But then Sina, who are these people? Well, that's another competitor to Google in China. And for some reason, investors are really excited about Sina's prospects. You with me? Understand? A P.E. of 109 means that investors are very, very optimistic. Or, and this is not as usual, but it could be that Sina's earnings have dropped precipitously. You see, if the price, you'll have to look at the denominator as well as the numerator. We tend to look at the numerator, the price. But if the denominator falls, then the quotient as a whole goes up, right? Think about a quotient. And investors are either closing their eyes to a situation that they do not wish to acknowledge, or they're just saying, we don't care, we're still bullish on this stock. Peter Lynch calls it the Wile E. Coyote effect. The stock flies off the goes off into the cliff, and there's nothing underneath it. The price either levitates very, very high, or maybe the earnings just disappear. And so the coyote is out there with nothing underneath them, and then they finally look at the audience and then look down, and then obviously the price falls. If we take a look at the biotech world, oh boy, do we see a huge variation. What's going on here? Well, that's again investors' expectations. You know some of these biotech companies are going to just become blockbusters. And in the case of Amgen, it's already happened. They're already a well-established big company. But these other ones, we're talking about the future, and we're excited about the future. What happens if that future doesn't come along the way exactly. Those parachutes had better be very large, because the price could drop very, very far. Now, if we look at the banks, we see the pattern we saw with the energy companies. The PEs are fairly close to one another, Citigroup being the lowest of the group. And we talked about price-to-book ratio, right? We'll get back to that, but I want you to remember Citigroup. We'll come back to that. Remind me. I probably will forget, but if I don't, I better tell you right now. I want you to go look up the book value of Citigroup, and you'll find, interestingly enough, that it's one of those unusual situations where the book value is less than the price of the stock. Now, is somebody going to be coming along and buying up Citigroup and liquidating its assets and paying off all the debts? No, it's not going to happen. But it's one of those scary situations. We take a look at the food companies, and we find a wider range here. Hormel, which makes Spam, is selling at a higher PE than General Mills or Kraft or Kellogg's, but they're food companies, right? I mean, yeah, exactly. They're not going anywhere. Some of them, every once in a while, will fall out of favor, and another one will come along. But for the most part, people got to eat food. If I were running Hormel, I would create an email marketing campaign, and in the title or in the whatever, in the big splash, I would say, "This is Spam," because they make Spam. And where does it come from? It comes from the fact that there's a Monty Python skit where the woman didn't want Spam, and that email that you don't want is Spam. But I would say, "This is Spam, and you'll want it because it's delicious and we think it's actually really neat." We're not really sure. But anyway, let's continue. Merck, drug company. Wow, people are really excited. But Pfizer and Lilly? Not so much. And then Bristol-Myers Squibb, they're back up with Merck. So what's going on here? Well, obviously investors are excited about Merck and Bristol-Myers, not so excited about Pfizer or Lilly. And lastly, we ask once again, are the investors correct in their pricing of these stocks? Well, no in 3 years, right? Well, no in 5 years. By then, it's too late, right? That's what makes horse races, as the Germans say. That's why there's a market out there. You pays your money and you takes your chances. But hopefully you've done the work we did in Chapter 6. You're going to learn how to do the ratio analysis here. And we're going to tilt the odds in your favor, right? Right? Of course, right. Let's continue. Slide number 11. How can we account for the wide price-to-earnings disparity between different industries and different companies within industries? Again, as we said, it is the expectation of future earnings and, in some cases, for companies that pay dividends, dividend growth by investors. What are investors expecting about the future? Now, here's something from the Random Walk Down Wall Street. It's a quote by the founder of the Dreyfus Funds, Jack Dreyfus. Dreyfus is now owned by the Bank of New York, which is the nation's oldest bank. He said, take a nice little company that has been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio. changed the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, mid-1960s, the words electronic and silicon are worth 15 times earnings. However, the real play comes from the word Firth Burner, which nobody understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your score. Therefore, we have 6 times earnings for the shoelace business, 15 times earnings for the electronics and silicon, or a total of 21 times earnings. Multiply this by 2 for the Firth Burners, and we now have a score of 42 times earnings for this new company. You see, it's a joke, folks. You know, it's tongue-in-cheek. Today, you replace Firth Burners with nanotechnology or 3D printing, and you replace electronics and silicon with social networking in China, and you technology changes, times change, but greed doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Okay. Slide number 12, the PEG ratio. This one's not that important, folks. People will quote it, but really all they're doing is comparing the P-E ratio with the growth ratio. And the idea, in general, is that your P-E ratio should roughly match your rate of growth. And, of course, if the two numbers are equal, you're going to get a P-E ratio of 1. If you take the stock P-E ratio divided by the earnings growth rate, and they're both 20, or they're both 15, or whatever, when two numbers are divided by the same number, one number is divided by the same number, you wind up with 1. So anything greater than 1 was considered high because you're willing to pay more than the growth rate with respect to the price to earnings. And anything less than 1 is obviously they think, oh, well, it's not going to grow that fast. We're not that excited about it. So we won't use the PEG ratio. You can calculate it if you want, but you don't hear that many people discussing it. Now, dividends per share, we already discussed that. You take the annual dividends paid to the stockholders divided by number of shares outstanding. We don't have to compute that. We just look it up. You did that in Chapter 5. As we discussed, dividends became taboo during the 1980s, 1990s. Since the 2000 to 2002 bear market, investors have changed their minds about dividends. Certainly the 2008 bear market, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter if you had dividends or not. Everybody fell down in 2008. Dividends can be discussed in polite company. Again, dividends don't lie. Slide number 14, the dividend yield. We're reviewing here, folks. This is the measure of how much dividends are as a percentage of the stock price. This important statistic allows an investor to compare a company to other forms of investments that pay income, such as savings accounts or bonds or CDs. Traditionally, 4 to 6 was considered very good. Currently, the S&P 500 is yielding about 2%. 10-year treasury bonds are yielding around 2.5%, a little bit higher than that. And they just touched 3% at the beginning of our year and then fell back down. And savings accounts are yielding far less than 1%, 1.01% some of them. Some stocks are paying much more than 2 or 3%, as I hope you'll see when you snoop around. And many high growth stocks are not paying any dividends, and nor do they make any noises as if they'll pay any dividends anytime soon. So the dividend yield, very important. Slide number 15, the dividend payout ratio, which we learned in Chapter 5. And not as important, although it's good to know how much of the earnings the company is paying out. You take the dividends per share and divide them by the earnings per share. And more mature companies often pay out almost all of their earnings in the form of dividends. Why? Because they don't need the earnings anymore. They don't need to reinvest back in the company. But growing companies retain their earnings, called retained earnings, to support the growth of the company. Make sense? Okay, good. Let's continue. Now, book value per share. We discussed this again. This is review from Chapter 5. Because book value is the net worth of a company on a per share basis, as reported by the accountants. In other words, what's the value on the books, on the accounting books? And you don't have to calculate it. It's the common stockholders' equity divided by the number of shares outstanding. You just look it up. And it tells an investor how much assets are behind each share of stock. In other words, if all the assets of the company were liquidated, how much would each shareholder receive? It is common for the actual market price of a share to be above the book value per share, since the company is normally worth more intact than if it were dissolved. Right? So you will see many companies selling at a price to book value of 3 or 4 times. The price is 3 or 4 times higher than the book value. And it's very rare that the market price will go below the book value. But when that happens, exactly, there's a real danger of the company being liquidated. And we just discussed this, slide 17. The price to book value per share, taking the market price and then dividing it by the book value per share. As we said, 3 to 4 is not uncommon. Some are higher. But I want you to go take a look at Citigroup and look at their book value per share. And as of this recording, their book value per share is actually greater than their market share. And this happened to many companies in the 2008 bear market. Many companies, especially the Japanese companies. And we're not talking small Japanese companies. Toyota, Honda, Sony, Panasonic. I mean, these are big Japanese companies, and they were selling for less than their book value per share. Not anymore. I haven't checked in the last, but I know they're all above it now. But Citigroup is one of the last of the debacle. They're still recovering. Slide 18, price to cash flow. Again, more review. The current price divided by the current cash flow per share. And as we said, cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons, but the most common reason is depreciation. Depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure, but there are many other reasons that cash flow and earnings differ. And as we talked about, the good quality versus the poor quality earnings, current price divided by the cash flow per share gives us the price to cash flow per share. And you may have used that in the bonus assignment for Chapter 6. During the internet mania, many companies were reporting record earnings. At the same time, their cash flow was negative. How can that be? It doesn't make any sense. Well, it sure does if you're selling things but not getting the cash for them, saying you'll get the cash 10, 20 years from now and then having that company disappear. And then let's finish by reviewing price-to-sales ratio. The current price divided by the annual sales per share. Historically, a higher price-to-sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth, and a lower price-to-sales ratio suggested a lower sales growth. And we look it up, or we calculate it by taking the current price divided by the annual sales per share. And as we said, during the internet mania, many analysts used price-to-sales instead of price-to-earnings, since most all of the new companies never generated any earnings. Okay, so these were the common stock market ratios, and we said this is review. So go back over this, but you've already taken a good look at these, especially in chapters 5 and 6. And when we come back, we will actually start to do some calculations now, because we will be looking at financial ratios that we have not discussed, profitability ratios, liquidity ratios, asset utilization ratios. So I apologize if this was a little bit of review for some of you, but hey, you know, listening to something over again is not always the worst thing in the world to do. so we'll see you in our next second presentation of Chapter 17, where we tackle some of these ratios that we have not seen so far.